Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. This event is part of a presidential dream course that Dr. Andrew Porwancher of the Institute for the American Constitutional Heritage and I are lucky enough to teach. I'm David Anderson, and I'm from the Department of English. So we want to thank President Boren and Provost Harper for their support of this event. It certainly would not have happened without them. Our students are in the middle of an interdisciplinary experiment that's combining literature, history, and political theory. And they're embarked on an interpretive enterprise. They're going to serve as delegates in a fictitious constitutional convention that will establish a new national constitution based on the principles inherent in John Milton's Paradise Lost. And so if that sounds strange, it is. But it's also fascinating. So we've just come from a fantastic class. I think all of us were a little bit disappointed that it had to end after an hour because we were enjoying it so much. And so I would like to summon my colleague, Andrew Porwancher, who will introduce our guest to you. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Anderson. This is now, I'm the only person on the planet who can say they've taught two dream courses with Dr. Anderson, and it's been the great privilege of my career here at OU. It is my honor today to introduce our guest, Philip Munoz, who is the Tocqueville Associate Professor of Religion and Public Life in the Department of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame, where he is also an associate professor at their eminent law school, and he is the director of the Tocqueville Program for Inquiry into Religion and Public Life, and our favorite title of his many titles here at OU, he is the founding director of the Botenziani Program in Constitutional Studies. And at OU, we're very proud that we are one of the pioneers in the field of constitutional studies, and so it's really a special treat for us to have the director of one of the sister programs from the University of Notre Dame here. Professor Munoz has also served as a fellow at Princeton University. He earned his PhD from the acclaimed political science program at Claremont Graduate University. He also has degrees from Boston College and Claremont McKenna College. He is an expert in church-state jurisprudence and an author of the award-winning book God and the Founders, Madison, Washington, and Jefferson, which was published by Cambridge University Press and was honored with the Hubert Morkin Award for the best book in religion and politics from the American Political Science Association. And in this extraordinarily influential book, Professor Munoz dispels the myth popular in common parlance that the founders subscribed to some monolithic view of church-state relations. And he argues that despite the fact that they do not speak with a single voice, that doesn't mitigate the value of the thought of the founding generation in trying to adjudicate constitutional controversies in our own time. In Professor Munoz's words, quote, "If any of the founders are to be consulted to guide contemporary church-state questions, it should be because of the profundity of their thought, not because of their status as the Constitution's authors." His book is an example of the power of history to inform constitutional issues today. His research has been supported by countless organizations, including the Earhart Foundation, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, the Institute for Humane Studies, many other sources. He's published numerous articles in leading journals and law reviews, published by the likes of the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard. He's been cited in the media. He has testified before Congress as an expert in church-state jurisprudence. And this is, we're proud to say, Professor Munoz's second visit to the University of Oklahoma. He originally came here in the spring of 2012 for our symposium on religious freedom. And as he recently learned, you know, once you come twice, you're basically signing on to come back every year, as David McCullough and Gordon Wood can testify. And so we're pleased that Professor Munoz has now entered that class of elite scholars who consider a trip to Norman an annual ritual. And so he's just learning this as I'm speaking. And so please join me in welcoming Professor Philip Munoz.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be back here with you. I want to thank Professor Porwancher and Professor Anderson. I had a delightful time in your class. Thank you for opening it up to me. Thank you for the kind invitation to be with you this evening. 4 years ago, as was mentioned, I helped found a program in constitutional studies at Notre Dame. When I was discussing our program, trying to convince our senior leadership that we ought to have a program in constitutional studies with our senior leadership, I would quote the following from Thomas Jefferson. This is from his book, his only book, Notes on the State of Virginia. Jefferson wrote, "Every generation degenerates when trusted to the rulers of the people alone. The people themselves, therefore, are its only safe depositories. And to render them safe, their minds must be improved to a certain degree." Jefferson, following his own counsel, founded public education in the state of Virginia, and of course he founded the University of Virginia. And Jefferson intended UVA to be where the citizens of Virginia and the future leaders of the nation would be instructed in the rights and liberties of our system of constitutional government. What you're doing here at the University of Oklahoma, at the Institute for American Constitutional Heritage, I think, is exactly what Jefferson said was necessary to preserve our rights and liberties. So I'd actually like to begin my talk by thanking you and thanking you for what you're doing for our nation. I want to recognize your senior leadership for having the foresight and the educational vision for starting this program. And I especially want to thank and recognize the senior leadership of IACH. This program is a model of what a public university, what any university in America should be doing. And I also want to commend you for the scholars you've brought here. I don't know if you students know this, but your faculty in academia, you have a faculty full of Kevin Durants and Russell Westbrooks. This is an all-star faculty. Professor Hertzke and Harper and Bill McClay and your young faculty that you're recruiting, really a phenomenal place to study. So consider yourself blessed and consider yourself thanks for what you're doing, not only for the state of Oklahoma, but for the nation as a whole. I don't know if I should say this. I hear this is being recorded, but our program at Notre Dame aspires to be exactly what you are right now. Okay, let me turn to my remarks for the evening. What I want to do with you for the next hour or so is to take you through the Hobby Lobby case, against the HHS mandate. This is not an altogether easy thing to do because things keep on changing. For all I know, they've changed since I wrote this talk a few days ago. And it's not altogether over, even though Hobby Lobby won a big victory last summer at the Supreme Court. It's not quite clear that the case is closed, and I'll try to explain why that's so. Right. So here's what I plan to do. I want to start off with Hobby Lobby's and Notre Dame's legal challenges to the HHS mandate. Notre Dame also filed suit, and in many ways Notre Dame's lawsuit is like Hobby Lobby's, but there's some interesting differences, and those differences portend for what may be the future for Hobby Lobby's case. So I'll talk a little bit about the mandate itself. I want to outline Notre Dame and Hobby Lobby's arguments, and then I want to step back and try to give you some historical constitutional context on why Hobby Lobby and Notre Dame are making the arguments they're making. I'll return back to the case and dive a little bit deeper into those legal arguments, and then I'll share a few of my thoughts about the future of religious liberty in America. My hope is that through this presentation, you'll have a better sense of how our law protects religious freedom. And as I said, I want to speculate or at least share some thoughts on how we might better protect religious liberty in the future. Okay, so let me start with the HHS mandate itself. I apologize if this is familiar knowledge to you, but I thought better to start with the facts. All right, the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, of course. It required all group health plans to provide, at no cost to participants, certain preventative services. Preventative services was a quote in the law. Remember when Nancy Pelosi said, we have to pass this law to find out what's in it? She sort of mocked for saying this, but right. But it was literally true, right? Congress had to pass the law to see what was in it because Congress passed general commands, preventative services be covered. But what was a preventative service? That was to be, the blanks were to be filled out or filled in through the executive bureaucracy, right? The ACA itself, the American Affordable Care Act, didn't specify what preventative services were. That job was designated to the Department of Health and Human Services. To do this, the Department of Health and Services, in turn, asked the Institute for Medicine, which is a non-governmental agency. They asked that the Institute for Medicine recommend a list of what should be covered. The Institute for Medicine recommended that all FDA-approved contraceptive methods be covered. This included certain devices and also sterilization methods. It also included the drug Ella, which is believed, at least by some, to act as an abortifacient. When HHS adopted the Institute for Medicine's recommendations, this was controversial, at least among religious groups. Religious groups pressured the White House to make exemptions for them. From my own conversations with Father Jenkins, president of Notre Dame, I know President Jenkins was talking to the White House directly. If you read the book Double Down about the 2012 presidential campaign, that book reports that Vice President Biden was lobbying for a very extensive accommodation for religious groups. Cardinal Dolan, the Archbishop of New York, was very vocal about how there needed to be a widespread accommodation for religious groups. Instead, what we got was a narrow accommodation. Now, there's an exemption to the HHS mandate in accommodation, and these are sort of precise terms in the law. The exemption means you're not subject to the HHS mandate. And the exemption is very narrowly drawn. It's only, you have the definition there before you. It doesn't include religious schools. It doesn't include religious hospitals. It doesn't include the University of Notre Dame. Imagine it, this includes the bishop's office and the bishop's employees, but not, say, Catholic schools more generally, right? It's limited to the exclusive religious activities of religious groups or religious orders, right? So very few groups qualify for the exemption. More groups qualify for the accommodation. The accommodation itself is changing. This is why it's difficult to exactly narrow or specify what the accommodation is. But in essence, the accommodation was given to nonprofits like the University of Notre Dame, not to for-profits. So Hobby Lobby did not qualify for the accommodation. But the accommodation would allow nonprofit groups like the University of Notre Dame to push off coverage of HHS-mandated products, contraceptions, abortifacients, to push those costs off to their insurance companies or their TPAs, their third-party administrators. I don't want to get too in the weeds here. A third-party administrator, Notre Dame is its own insurance company, but we hire an administrator called a third-party administrator to administrate our insurance plan. Okay, how was the HHS mandate enforced? Now, this is interesting. So I'm not sure if these are fines or taxes. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to call them now. Notre Dame or Hobby Lobby could simply not issue health insurance to its employees. And if it did not issue health insurance to its employees, they would be fined or taxed $2,000 per year per employee. So for Hobby Lobby, 13,000 employees, that's $26 million a year. Notre Dame, we have 5,000 employees, but 2,500 women. Roughly $5 million a year to not issue insurance. Let me just add, I called our HR office a couple days ago to ask how many employees Notre Dame had, and they were very suspicious of me. They would not give me an answer. In fact, they asked for my name and who I was. I told them, I'm in the next building over. But the woman said she had to call me back because I think she looked me up on the internet and was trying to actually, she wanted to know why I wanted to know how many employees we had. Realize it was so controversial. Anyway, so about $5 million. So Notre Dame decides not to issue insurance. We simply, $5 million, I mean, what's $5 million? It's a decent offensive coordinator nowadays, right? But here's what's interesting. If we issued insurance, or if Hobby Lobby issued insurance but did not comply with the HHS mandate, right? So you issue insurance but don't pay for the contraception and abortifacients. The fine is $100 a day per eligible employee. For Hobby Lobby, that's $1.3 million a day, $475 million a year. You don't issue insurance at all, you pay $26 million. You issue insurance but not contraception, $475 million. That's interesting, isn't it? Right? And I don't know why HHS structured the fines as it did. Right? But I think if you push it might be revealing. Right? You put your money where your mouth is, and HHS wanted this fight. Right? I mean, they could have made the fines relatively small, right? And then people who didn't want to comply with the mandate for objections could have just paid the fine. But they ratcheted up the fines. And, I mean, they ratcheted up the fines. Okay? $91 million a year for Notre Dame not to comply. I mean, that's a lot of football coaches. Notre Dame's arguments and Hobby Lobby's arguments. There's three main arguments. One is a First Amendment argument. One is a federal law argument. Well, two are federal law arguments. The first federal law is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a law passed in 1993, and then the Administrative Procedures Act. All the cases against the HHS mandate, and there's been a lot of cases. There's something like 56 nonprofit cases against the HHS mandate, and some of these cases have multiple plaintiffs, so I can't remember the exact number, but something like 140 nonprofit plaintiffs. I think it's about 50 for-profit cases, with almost 200 plaintiffs. So there's been lots of litigation against this. Pretty much all the litigation has three basic arguments, a First Amendment argument, and then two federal law arguments. Okay, I'm going to try to give you a little context and go back in history to explain why these arguments, especially why the focus is on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and I want to explain why, and why it's going to be on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and probably not the First Amendment. That requires a little bit of history. I say there's three eras of free exercise jurisprudence, right? The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. I'm focusing on the free exercise part. Three eras, right? This is my terminology, but I think it's not that controversial. The first era is what I call the Reynolds era. It starts in 1879 because the first significant free exercise case is in 1879. And the Reynolds is a case. It's actually a very interesting case. In some ways, it could be a case that we might hear in the next few years. George Reynolds was secretary to Brigham Young, so BYU University, that Brigham Young. Right? He's a personal secretary to Brigham Young. Mormons at the time, not now, but at the time, practiced polygamy. And George Reynolds was asked to take a second wife. This was in the territory of Utah. It's a federal territory and therefore under the jurisdiction of federal law. First Amendment applies to federal law. George Reynolds is arrested for bigamy or convicted of bigamy, and he's given, a $500 fine and sentenced to multiple years of hard labor. Here, the requisite joke is, well, of course he was. I mean, married a second wife, right? Reynolds sues, and he says, look, I took a second wife for religious reasons. There's no doubt about this. He was asked to take a second wife. He was a faithful Mormon. Mormons at the time practiced polygamy, right? There's no doubt about Reynolds' sincerity. There's no doubt that this was understood. I mean, if you know anything about Mormonism, marriage is very central to the Mormon religion. This was an accepted in Mormon practice. Among Mormons, they practiced polygamy. He was doing so for religious reasons. George Reynolds says, the First Amendment protects the free exercise of religion. I am exercising my religion, and I'm arrested for it. Okay, interesting case, right? You could see this case coming about today. The Supreme Court ruled against George Reynolds, and this is its first significant free exercise case. The case before the court, or the question before the court, is: does George Reynolds get an exemption from the law? We're not going to strike down bigamy or polygamy law prohibitions for everyone, but does George Reynolds get an exemption? And the Supreme Court says no, and they quote Thomas Jefferson, and they actually quote his famous Wall of Separation letter, Right? This is where the first case where you get the Wallace separation letter. I'll let you read the quote, but the court essentially says the First Amendment protects beliefs, not actions. You can believe whatever you want to believe. You can't be prosecuted for your beliefs, but you can. We can legislate actions. Marriage is an action. Therefore, marriage is not protected by the First Amendment. George Reynolds does not get an exemption. The First Amendment does not give exemptions to generally applicable laws. Right? That's the precedent set in 1879. And that's the precedent that holds all the way till 1963. 1963, we get a case called Sherbert versus Verner. An absolutely fascinating case. You couldn't make this case up if you wanted to. It's a little old lady, Adele Sherbert. She works in a textile factory in South Carolina. She's worked at the same textile factory for 35 years. She's a Seventh Day Adventist. So she, for religious reasons, she doesn't work on Saturday. At the time, the typical work week in that industry at that place was 6 days a week, right? So people didn't work on Sunday, but everyone who worked in textile factories worked on Saturday. Okay. Sherbert has an accommodation through an employer, right? They have an agreement. She just works 5 days a week, does this for decades. The textile factory is sold, new owners. They say she has to work on Saturday. She doesn't show up for work. She doesn't work for religious reasons on Saturday. This happens, I think, 8 weeks in a row. She gets fired. Gets fired for not showing up for work when scheduled. She files a claim for unemployment insurance. The state of South Carolina denies her unemployment insurance, right? And they say, look, you had a job. You were fired for good cause. You didn't show up for work. You don't qualify for unemployment insurance. Adele Sherbert sues, saying her religious freedom rights have been violated, right? She did not show up for work for religious reasons. To not give her unemployment insurance or award her unemployment insurance is to the same as to fine her for a religion. And she wins. In an opinion written by with a six-member majority, the real author of the opinion is Justice Brennan, who had been arguing for this interpretation for a few years. Right? Brennan says the ruling that the denial of unemployment insurance forces her to choose between following the precepts of her religion or forfeiting benefits. That's the same as fining someone for religion. That's a prohibited by the Free Exercise Clause. What's developed is known as the Sherbert Doctrine or the Sherbert Test. Right? When a statute burdens religion, an individual has a presumptive right to an exemption from that law. Right? So it's not, you don't get unemployment insurance if you just want to stay home and watch football on Saturday. Right? Even though I understand in some parts of the country that's like a religion. Right? It has to be for a bona fide religious reason. But if your religion is burdened, right, and a general neutrally applicable law has the effect of burdening your religion, you have a presumptive right to an exemption. Now, if the state has a compelling reason that it still has to carry out that law, you don't automatically get the exemption, but you have a presumptive right to an exemption. That's known as the Sherbert Doctrine or the Sherbert Test. And that's how the First Amendment is interpreted from 1960 through 1990, our second era of constitutional free exercise jurisprudence. Our third era starts in 1990. This, again, I mean, these cases, you can't really make them up. Even if you wanted to, you couldn't come up with this one. These two guys, Alfred Smith and Galen Black, their names don't suggest it, but they practice a Native American religion. They're members of the Native American Church. It's a proper name. It's called the Native American Church. The Native American Church ingests peyote. I'll presume you don't know what that is, even though Jacob in the front row here is nodding. Peyote, right, is a hallucinogenic that you ingest. I think this was out in Central Oregon. These Native American tribes, they practice the religion. They ingest this peyote. It's usually not a drug that's abused because it's not always pleasant, I'm told. Anyways, it's an hallucinogenic. So these two guys, Alfred Smith and Galen Black, they go to work. They go partake in this Native American ceremony. They ingest peyote. They go to work. They get drug tested. They test positive. They're fired from their jobs. Any guess what their jobs are? They're drug counselors for the state of Oregon. They file for unemployment insurance. The state of Oregon denies them unemployment insurance. This is not hard to imagine, right? I mean, you kind of wish I wish I could see the letter, right? The letter, I imagine, went something like this. You're a drug counselor that tested positive for drugs. You don't get unemployment insurance. They sue. Right? Our situation is the same as Mrs. Sherbert's situation. Now, there's an interesting backstory here, and I won't spend too much time on it. And there's only like four people in the room that will understand what I'm talking about, because you have to be of a certain age to understand it. This is all happening in the mid-'80s in the state of Oregon. And you wonder, why didn't the state of Oregon just give these guys their unemployment insurance? The Supreme Court precedent was relatively clear. And the answer is because the Attorney General at the time, he didn't want to have any exemptions for religious reasons, because there's this guy called, and I'm not making this up, there's a guy called the Bhagwan Rajneesh. Anyone remember the Bhagwan Rajneesh? Yeah, yeah. The old guys in the back remember. The Bhagwan Rajneesh, I actually tried to Google this to get some details, but I couldn't figure out how to spell Bhagwan Rajneesh. But I still remember when I was in high school, there was a 60 Minutes episode on this guy. And he was an Indian, he was from the country of India, and he was a cult leader. And he set up a camp in the middle of Oregon. And for reasons that are still not clear to me, all these very wealthy people from New Jersey started moving out to the middle of Oregon. And, you know, they set up a compound. And I still remember the 60 Minutes episode. He had a fleet of Rolls Royces. And so the Attorney General of the state of Oregon has, in his perception, this religious cult in the middle of the state that was dangerous. I mean, maybe this is slightly easier for us to understand today. But they started this, the members of the cult started moving into certain cities. They started running candidates in school board elections. They were found in one small town in Oregon. They started putting food poisoning. They started poisoning all the salad bars in the local restaurants so people would be sick on election day so their candidates would win. I mean, I you can't make this stuff up. So the Attorney General in the state of Oregon does not want to give these two Native American church practitioners an exemption because he doesn't want exemptions to be extended to this cult in the middle of the state. So this case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. It's sent back down to the state of Oregon, goes all the way up to the Supreme Court again. And in a shocking decision at the time, 6-3 the decision, the Supreme Court, for all but a few cases, reverses the Sherbert test or the Sherbert case and goes back to the Reynolds standard for the most part. It's a little bit more complicated than that. The author of the opinion is Justice Scalia, right? And Scalia writes, no exemptions. Okay, that happens in 1990. 1993, we get the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Congress did not like the Smith decision. And Congress said, you, the Supreme Court, got it wrong. Overwhelming bipartisan support to pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And basically, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act reinstituted, for purposes of federal law, the Sherbert test, right? So if a law burdens your religion, you have a presumptive right to an exemption from the law unless there's a compelling state interest, and they added a least restrictive means. So if the state is pursuing a compelling state interest in the least restrictive means possible, then the state can burden your religion, but short of that, you get an exemption from the law. Now, there's also another Supreme Court case in 1993. This, too, is a crazy case. It's in the city outside of Miami. It's a Santeria group, a religious group. Santeria is a mixture of Catholicism and elements of Cuban religion, elements of Voodooism. I won't go into the details, but this group, Santeria sort of practiced in the shadows at the time, and there's a group, and they want to go public. So they have these plans for a private school, a museum, and all these other things. And the city of Hialeah tries to outlaw the practice of Santeria religion. Gets to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court rules for the Church of the Lukumi Babalui, and they say in their ruling, laws that are not generally applicable, that is, laws that target religious practices, or will be held under the Sherbert standard. Okay. It's a little bit complicated, but it will make a little bit more sense in just a second. Go back to the Hobby Lobby's and Notre Dame's arguments, right? So the First Amendment argument is the HHS mandate is not a generally applicable and neutral law. And therefore, we Hobby Lobby or we Notre Dame deserve an exemption under the Santeria standard. Okay. If we don't win on that, they say, Hobby Lobby and Notre Dame say, we're protected by the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Religious Freedom Restoration Act was actually struck down as applied to states, but not to federal law. Still good law for federal cases. The third argument is under the Administrative Procedures Act, and the basic argument there is that the law was not properly enacted, at least when it was implemented by the Department of Health and Human Services. I don't know anything about administrative law, so I have no idea if that's a good argument or not. Courts have not paid attention to it, as far as I can tell. I mean, it is interesting. We only bring it up for this reason. I mean, one, it's one of the arguments made. But if the Supreme Court wanted to get rid of the HHS mandate but did not want to rule on religious freedom grounds, it actually might be able to do so through this argument under the Administrative Procedures Act. I don't actually know if that's a good argument because I don't know the law, but that's the beauty of it. No one knows if it's a good argument. So if the Supreme Court wanted to do that, they probably could. Okay. The focus of the Hobby Lobby decision and continued Hobby Lobby litigation in Notre Dame's case is right here under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. There's good reasons for that. There's a basic canon of jurisprudence. A court is supposed to, if it's going to strike down a law, generally on the narrowest grounds possible. So if a law violates both the First Amendment and a federal law, you can simply set aside the federal law. You don't have to reach the First Amendment grounds. So there are other reasons why the focus has been on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I think that's where it's going to be in the future as well. So I want to take you through the arguments in more detail on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Okay? What you have here, this is not, I don't know, you wouldn't see this in a law school textbook or anything like that. This is my own breaking down, the way I break down this when I teach it. There's, under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, there's three threshold questions and then a balancing test. Right? The Religious Freedom Restoration Act protects religious entities. So the first question is the litigant bringing a suit based on a sincere religious objection? And occasionally lawsuits get filed and courts rule, look, this is not sincere, this is a sham. That's not issue at issue, certainly in Hobby Lobby, and it's even not at issue in Notre Dame. The second threshold question is, assuming the litigant is sincere, are the litigants actually burdened in their religious exercise? Is there actual burden? And we'll talk about that more in a minute because that's very much at the heart of the case. And then because the statute says substantial burdens, is the burden substantial? Now, if you are sincere, if you are burdened, and if that burden is substantial, if you can answer yes to all that questions, then the court engages in a balancing test, right? Now, so just because you're burdened doesn't mean you'll get an exemption, right? The state can still burden your religious exercise if the state is pursuing a compelling state interest and if it's doing so in the least restrictive means possible. Okay? And now, you're probably thinking, what's a compelling state interest? What are the least restrictive means? That's not altogether clear. That's why we have litigation. Okay? I'm going to go to the burden point two a little bit more deeply, right? How do you know if a burden exists? Now, this is very much a question the courts are trying to answer. And I think they're going to focus on two earlier Supreme Court cases. These are Supreme Court cases when the Supreme Court was still using the Sherbert standard. And I think these are the clearest statements of how the Supreme Court decided when a burden is a burden. Right? When the government affirmatively compels, by threat of sanction, a litigant to refrain from religiously motivated conduct or to engage in conduct they find objectionable for religious reasons. It's a 1986 case. So, or you're coerced to practice a religion or not to practice your religion. I mean, that's a relatively commonsensical definition as well, right? So that's when a burden exists. I'll come back to this in a little bit. Given the law and given these doctrinal standards, here's Hobby Lobby's argument in a nutshell. First, Hobby Lobby tries to establish its sincere in its religious beliefs. it's not very difficult to do. I mean, Hobby Lobby has a clear track record of that it's a religiously motivated company. They close their stores on Sunday. They pay a good wage for religious reasons. They don't sell certain products that they find morally objectionable. They close, I think, their stores early at 8 p.m. so people don't have to stay too late. You know, presumably, I'm not sure about this, but I just presume it's so, you know, hopefully their employees can get home, put their children to bed, right? They're a faith-filled company, and no one disputes that. Their second argument is that, so we're sincere in our religious beliefs. Hobby Lobby is a religious company. That's what they're trying to show. Second thing is, and our religious faith is burdened. They say our religious faith is burdened because the Greens are the owners of Hobby Lobby, right? They can't provide access to, pay for, train others to obtain abortions. And the HHS mandate includes abortifacients. Right, we can't pay for abortion. Now, Hobby Lobby didn't object to they didn't object to most of the forms of contraception that were covered, just the four forms that they perceived to be abortifacients. So there's a real burden, right? We have a religious belief that life begins at conception. We can't partake in abortions. You're making us pay for abortions. That's a burden on our religious practice. And that burden is substantial. Why is that burden substantial? $475 million. The government's argument in response is on threshold question number two. The government's response was Hobby Lobby. I mean, clearly Hobby Lobby is religious, right? There's no doubt the sincerity of the Green family. But they argued that there's no burden here. There's no religious burden. And the strategy was to say that because Hobby Lobby is a corporation, corporations do not have religious, cannot exercise a religion. If a corporation cannot exercise religion, a corporation cannot be covered under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So there's no entity to be religiously burdened. That was the main argument of the government. There were variations of this argument. The district court in Hobby Lobby's case said, look, the Green family is only burdened indirectly, not substantially, because the Green family, it's their company that's burdened, not them personally. Right. This is why all the talk about corporations aren't people, corporations can't exercise religion. All that talk was about this argument, right? Is Hobby Lobby as a company protected by the Religious Freedom Restoration Act? Supreme Court said, well, we'll look at the text of the Act itself. And according to the Supreme Court, the text of the Act itself clearly includes Hobby Lobby under its protection. Corporations, or at least closely held corporations, the Supreme Court said, are protected. And there's good reasons for this, too. I mean, I think this was not, at least from a legal standpoint, you could argue corporations shouldn't be protected, but just as a legal analysis, given the statute as written, it does not seem to be a complicated question to me, even a very difficult question. It's not actually complicated. I mean, the idea that a corporation cannot exercise religion, I mean, that's sort of obviously true in one sense, but we talk about corporate social responsibility or ethical corporations. Well, if a corporation can be responsible and ethical, why can't it also be religious? Right. There seems to be this presumption if you try to make money, you can't be religious. And that's not, I see no reason why. I mean, it could be that you want to make money and you're not religious, but you can also, you know, go into business for religious reasons and operate your company for with religious guidelines, right? And that's the whole ethic of corporate social responsibility is premised on that. So this did not seem to me a very difficult question under the law or just in thinking about what a corporation can be, right? I mean, corporation is a legal fiction to organize for specific reasons, right? Okay. So the Supreme Court rejected the government's main argument that there is no religious burden present. Okay. So Hobby Lobby, it was not challenged that Hobby Lobby was sincere. The Supreme Court said they were burdened. The Supreme Court said, look, the burden is substantial because of the fine. So then we get to the balancing test, right? Hobby Lobby's argument under the balancing test was the government has not asserted a compelling state interest. The government's stated compelling state interest was we want to prevent unwanted and unintended pregnancies. That's the interest the government put forward. That's why we have the HHS mandate. Hobby Lobby's response was, well, that interest might be very important, but look, there are all sorts of holes in the HHS mandate, in the law. grandfathered plans, that is plans that were in effect before 2010, are not covered by the HHS mandate by statute. Small companies, if you have less than 50 people, you're not subject to Obamacare. If you employ less than 50 people, you're not subject to Obamacare. Some employees are given the accommodation, which I referred to at the beginning of the talk. Other narrower set are given the exemption. Hobby Lobby argued, if this really is a compelling interest, there wouldn't be all these exemptions and exceptions and holes in the law. The lack of universality belies the government's argument that it's a compelling state interest. The Supreme Court didn't actually focus on this. The Supreme Court said, look, we're just going to assume there's a compelling state interest because we don't have to answer that question. Because the Supreme Court said, we're going to decide the case on the least restrictive means. And so you have to, according to the balancing test, the government has to be pursuing a compelling state interest using the least restrictive means. Hobby Lobby's argument was really simple. Look, if the government wants to have people have abortifacients, the government can simply buy people abortifacients. Why are you making us buy them for our employees? If you, the government, want our employees to have abortifacients, buy them yourself. Or fund Planned Parenthood. Or give tax credits. There's all sorts of ways we can get birth control and abortifacients into people's hands without forcing, Hobby Lobby was saying, without forcing us to provide the coverage for them. And the Supreme Court said, look, you, the government, had already offered an accommodation for nonprofits. That would be a less burdensome way than forcing Hobby Lobby to pay for the insurance to cover abortifacients. If you can do it for nonprofits, you can do it for-profits. So the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby. But no, the Supreme Court did not say that Hobby Lobby gets an exemption for the law. In fact, all the Supreme Court said was, you, the government, you, the Department of Health and Human Resources, have to find a better way, right, a more accommodating way to provide this coverage. And that's what the government is doing right now. Okay? So it was a 5-4 decision at the Supreme Court. The key points, closely held corporations can exercise religion, and therefore they're protected under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Hobby Lobby suffered a substantial burden. This is a quote from Justice Kennedy. I put a quote from Justice Kennedy up because he's going to be the decisive vote. He's probably the fifth vote in these matters. No need to determine that there's a compelling state interest because the state clearly is not, the government that is not using the least restrictive means possible. Okay, that's what the court decided last summer. What does that mean now? The government has to come up with a new way to accommodate Hobby Lobby. And the latest version, this has not been finalized as far as I know, is that Hobby Lobby and groups like Notre Dame would have to notify the HHS that what they find morally or religiously objectionable. Then HHS will notify the insurance company, and HHS or the government will make the insurance company pay for this. That might resolve the case. But it might not, because it's not clear that Hobby Lobby will accept this accommodation. When Hobby Lobby writes the letter to notify the Department of Health and Human Services, that triggers the government to contact the insurance company to provide the abortifacients that Hobby Lobby finds objectionable. So Hobby Lobby's letter is the trigger that starts the coverage. Hobby Lobby doesn't want to pay directly for the insurance. Is Hobby Lobby willing to write the letter that leads to insurance companies having to pay for abortifacients? I don't know the answer to that question. But that's the question that Hobby Lobby, I think, is going to have to answer for itself. I brought up Notre Dame's case earlier because it's not clear that Notre Dame will accept this accommodation. Maybe they will. I don't know. But it is clear that not all religious nonprofits will accept it. Case being heard right now, EWTN. Do they allow EWTN in Oklahoma? It's a Catholic television network. EWTN is subject to the accommodation. And EWTN has filed suit. And EWTN has said, look, because someone is employed by us, they're going to get abortifacients. We don't want to be a part of the process. They use the analogy. They say, imagine that we owned a hospital and we didn't want to perform abortions. Okay? Good reason why a Catholic hospital wouldn't want to perform abortions. So you, the government, says, okay, you don't have, your doctors don't have to perform an abortion, right? You just have to open your doors up so we can bring a doctor to your hospital and we'll perform the abortion and we'll pay for the doctor to perform it in your hospital. Well, EWTN is saying, look, we don't want the abortion done on our premises. We don't want you to hijack our premises to perform abortions. We don't want you to hijack our insurance plan to use it to provide abortifacients. That's their argument. So at least some nonprofits, and possibly Hobby Lobby, you know, I don't know what Hobby Lobby is going to say, will not find this new accommodation acceptable. So last summer we had Hobby Lobby. That might have been just round one. Okay. That's where we are in the case. Let me speculate just for a second here before I offer a few more thoughts on how to protect religious freedom. Because the obvious question, well, is this accommodation acceptable, not to Hobby Lobby, but to the Supreme Court? How would the Supreme Court vote on this? I don't know. I know there are four votes to say that this accommodation is acceptable. So there's four votes against EWTN. I know that. Because those four have already said they're not in favor of accommodation. I think the key question is, what would Justice Kennedy do? And, you know, who knows what Justice Kennedy will do? I suspect if Hobby Lobby challenges this, that they will lose, right? That the government has structured the accommodation in such a way Hobby Lobby's employees will get free abortifacients despite Hobby Lobby's objections. Hobby Lobby itself will not have to pay directly, but the insurance company that they hire will have to pay directly. That's my best prediction. I think Hobby Lobby, if Hobby Lobby challenges again, that they will lose. But you never know. I mean, Hobby Lobby has some very good lawyers at the Beckett Fund. They're very, very good, but we'll see. Let me say a few words about the future of religious liberty. And if you don't mind, I'd like to quote Abraham Lincoln. You know, this is a year of many anniversaries, 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War. So I've been thinking a lot about Lincoln. And I went back and reread one of his early speeches. Lincoln gave a speech called the Perpetuation Address, and he gave the speech when he was a young guy. He's 28 years old, sort of remarkable. I mean, I think, you know, what was I doing when I was 28? I wasn't writing speeches like this. Lincoln said, this is how he began his speech. He says, "As a subject for the remarks of the evening, the perpetuation of our political institutions is selected. In the great journal of things under the sun, we, the American people, find our account running under date of the 19th century of the Christian era. We find ourselves in peaceful protection of the fairest portion of the earth as regards to the extent of territory, fertility of soil, salubrity of climate. We find ourselves under the government of a system of political institutions conducing more essentially to the ends of civil and religious liberty than any of which the history of former times tells us." What Lincoln said about America in 1838 is still true today, I think. Whatever our differences, we are blessed to live in a nation that celebrates religious liberty. You know, recently we've seen the absolute worst kind of religious violence and brutality imaginable. I mean, men beheaded, burned alive, women sold into slavery because of their religious beliefs, right? I mean, this is awful. And it's barbaric, and I hope we crush it. What's made America exceptional from the founding is, whatever our nation's failures in practice, we have always aspired to be a nation of liberty and a nation of laws, a nation dedicated to the natural right of religious liberty. And this is a moment in our history where I think we need to go back to rely on and reaffirm our founding principles. We need to reaffirm our commitment to religious freedom. And that's going to require us to be honest about what threatens religious freedom. In fundamental ways right now, our nation is divided. And one of our deepest divisions is about matters of human sexuality. And I actually think we don't talk frankly enough about this. Some Americans, we can call them traditionalists, hold that human sexuality ought to be guided by a moral law that they themselves do not create, a moral law that you can find in the philosophic tradition of the natural law or you can find in the Bible, right? Different ways of reaching the moral law, but the same conclusions. In this traditional understanding, men and women are understood to be accountable to, called to live up to a moral standard in all matters of life, but especially in human sexuality, a standard that they themselves do not create. The other position in contemporary culture right now, just call this the modern view, holds that men and women are and ought to be their own moral authors on all things, including human sexuality. This view, at its essence, adopts human willfulness as the essential character of human beings. So what's right and wrong in matters of human sexuality is determined by the individual for the individual. Now, there's one exception here. The only universal rule is consent. Sex must be consensual. That actually follows, though. Sex must be consensual because the ultimate authority on matters of human sexuality is human willfulness, right? So consent is connected to the will. Because in this view, the individual person determines what's right and wrong, the individual should be sovereign in all matters of human sexuality. These two views are obviously in tension with one another. The latter view is not compatible with a robust understanding of religious freedom. So our question is, what are we going to do? Right. We're a nation very much divided, and we need to figure out a way to live together. There seems to me, to simplify, two options before us. Option one is to use the coercive force of law to criminalize and penalize the views with which we disagree. And in my view, this is exactly what the HHS mandate tried to do. In her capacity as Secretary of Health and Human Services, Secretary Sebelius attempted to force her view of human sexuality on the nation as a whole, and she was willing to use the whole force of the United States government and ruinous fines to do so. That approach is a mistake, and it would be a mistake, I think, if the other side, if the traditional view, tried to do the same thing. We have to convince each other with argument, not with the force of law and million-dollar penalties. So I think we need to find a way to live together. This means recognizing our differences and, to some degree, accepting our differences. It certainly, I think, should allow generous exemptions for conscience, which is what Hobby Lobby and Notre Dame have requested, or as an alternative, and perhaps this might be a better alternative, and I only have time to mention this in passing, though we certainly can talk about it, perhaps we should try to depoliticize matters of human sexuality. Right? Not everything needs to be a political battle. Given our fundamental disagreement about human sexuality and how it ought or ought not to be guided, perhaps it might be best if we simply did not make anybody pay for anybody else's birth control. Whatever route we take, whatever path we choose, it is certainly my hope that we choose a path that adopts a robust understanding of religious freedom. Understanding that right to religious freedom is what you here at the University of Oklahoma are doing. So again, I conclude in applauding you in your efforts. Thank you for being such an attentive audience, and it would be a pleasure to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
We have time for just a few questions. Sorry, I'd ask that you not ask like a three-part question. But with the caveat that Professor Munoz has generously offered to stay after and chat one-on-one with anyone who has further questions. So I'll just leave it to you to call him.
Please, just do me a favor and just stand up so I can see you and tell me who you are. Yeah, and students first. Let's get any students. Please.
What I wanted to know was, why do you think the Supreme Court decided not to strike down the law instead of just telling the government they needed to relook at the law?
Well, because they could decide the case without striking it down, right? And the Supreme Court doesn't have to rule on the narrowest grounds possible, but as a general rule, they follow. And so they could dispose of the case in this narrow way. And it's in some ways it's deferential to the political process. You know, Obama administration was duly elected by the American people. What they were doing, Supreme Court said, was not compatible with the law. So you give it back to them and let them try to come up with a solution that is compatible with the law. I mean, the other reason is there weren't five votes to strike it down.
Okay.
Well, I was thinking that's what I'd make my next talk here at the University of Oklahoma. Perhaps next fall before a football game, perhaps. Yeah, what do I mean by depoliticizing, right? Let me use an example. So I do, my specialty is religious freedom and the founding. And so in colonial Virginia, the Anglican Church was established. So, you know, King of England is the head of the Anglican Church. The American Revolution means we're going to have to change church-state arrangements in Virginia, right? So after we win the Revolutionary War, there's a big question. Well, what religion are we going to establish? Right, we had the Anglican Church. Well, should we now establish the Episcopalian Church? Should we establish the Presbyterian Church? Should we have some combination of multiple established churches? And the presumption is, well, the government must establish some religious church, right? And James Madison and Thomas Jefferson said, you know, actually, no. Religion will be just fine if we don't establish any church. Right? We can actually just not legislate on the matter. We can depoliticize religion. So we don't have to fight over which church to establish. We can actually all agree to religious freedom. Well, could we do something similar in matters of sexuality? Right? I mean, we can choose to have lots of battles over sex ed in schools. I mean, we've been having these battles and they're just going to get worse. Or maybe we can leave sex ed out of schools. Would it really be so terrible to let parents take control of their kids' sexual education? So that would be one example. Right? Do all these things have to be... I mean, when things are decided by politics, it means ultimately they are decided by the force of law. And it's not clear to me that we need to put the... I mean, look, there's some fights that are unavoidable, but let's try to find all the avoidable fights and not have those. But that's going to require us to actually agree to tolerate others that we have fundamental disagreements with. But look, if you know, if the Baptist and Episcopalians could do that 200 years ago, right? Because the only alternative is we fight, and we're ruining people's lives. Now this goes to both sides, and I would rather not see us do that. Please. Just the abortifacients. Though other lawsuits, like Notre Dame, it was all the... Because Catholic Church teaches against contraception, so Notre Dame doesn't want to cover any of them. But Hobby Lobby just... There's 20 approved contraceptive methods. Hobby Lobby only objected to 4 of them.
Then would Notre Dame be more successful and less successful in the court's ruling if they
want to? Presumptively, if the court were to follow... the Hobby Lobby example and rule in favor of Notre Dame, I presume it would say Notre Dame does not have to cover anything that Notre Dame does not, that they are exempt from or they can be accommodated in all those things that Notre Dame finds objectionable. Hobby Lobby only asked for an accommodation or an exemption from those 4 things, the other things they had no problems with. Please. Yeah, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that question. I'm going to say 2 things that are not incompatible, but they go down slightly different tracks. I mean, I just think the Obama administration thinks this is the reasonable and right thing to do. The Obama administration thinks these are FDA-approved methods. We are a nation that has a constitutional right protecting abortion. People need these products, and we ought to get them to as many people as we can. Right? That is a political good, and they see themselves doing political good. Right? So I think, I mean, there's a good faith effort. I mean, it's no secret where the political left stands on these matters. Right? So I think they're doing good as they understand good. I will say, though, I think the Obama administration picked this fight. And I say that because of the way they structured their fines. It is not reasonable to say we'll have a $13 million fine for not having insurance, but a $475 million fine for having insurance but not contraception. And right, that's hard for me to understand. Maybe there's a good reason. And I think they picked this fight because think they thought it was a political winner. And it was. They were right. Right? The Obama and the war on women became the central a central issue in 2012, and Obama won re-election. So I think it was a fight that they wanted to have. They didn't go out of their way. I mean, they could have accommodated. I thought President Obama would call Father John Jenkins, the president of Notre Dame, to the White House, and after all this pressure to have an accommodation, have a big press conference, Notre Dame embracing the Obama administration, Obama saying, look, I didn't realize that this was going to be so contentious. Yes, I will grant you your accommodation, right? And it would be a big political do, and this would help secure Catholic votes in what was going to be a close election. But the Obama administration didn't do that. In fact, they did the opposite. They ran on the war on women, and they won. So I think it was, in some ways, they're doing what they think's right, and they think what is right to do is also good politics.
I think we do maybe one more question.
Okay, one more. Please. Well, it focused it is what I'd say. I mean, this division wasn't caused by the mandate. I mean, it was already there, right? We're just exiting a major cultural revolution, right? The sexual revolution is a big deal, and we are trying to figure out what that means, right? And you know, through law is one of the ways to figure it out. And so this is, we're going to have more and more of these battles in different ways. And it's very much my hope that we can find a peaceful way to resolve them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.